You're listening to Voices from the 2008 ACLU Membership Conference. I'm Matt Dellinger. With me is Alex Gibney, the award-winning filmmaker. His 2006 Oscar-nominated Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, was one of the top-grossing documentaries of all time. And just this year, the film Taxi to the Dark Side won the Oscar for Best Documentary. Welcome, Alex.
Good to be here.
I'd like to play a little clip from Taxi to the Dark Side, which is it's a documentary about the mistreatment and death of an innocent Afghan detainee. And what we're going to hear is a narration of witnesses about what happened to Dilawar, a 22-year-old taxi driver who was killed.
He was in the airlock, standing there with a hood over his head. He had his hands tied above his head, and he was moaning.
There's like four MPs on this guy, and one of the MPs just kept giving him kidney shots. The other two, they slammed him to the ground. And then the fourth one, like, jumped on his back. He got a big gash on his nose.
Dilawar was taken to an isolation cell where the knee strikes continued. In her statement at trial, the Army coroner said his lower limbs looked like they had been run over by a bus. Had he lived, it would have been necessary to amputate his legs.
So there's a real brutality to the details of this case, and I'm wondering what the experience was collecting this dark information, and also what the reaction has been to the film.
Well, look, I mean, the Dilawar's case in particular, as well as some of the related abuses, presented us with a chronicle of really devastating behavior. Particularly in the case of Dilawar, it was a five-day interrogation, and after the third day, his interrogators had by and large concluded that he was utterly innocent, and yet the mistreatment continued until he was dead. And it was, as you heard, a brutal mistreatment. It wasn't always that way with every detainee, but we found a pattern of that kind of mistreatment. And it was difficult to watch and difficult material to reckon with. But what we found in terms of a reaction, mm-hmm. is that this is a subject that I think that's very hard for people to hear, because it's about us. In a way, it's about all of us. This is something that's being done in our name, and I think there are many of us also who feel that, look, whatever they have to do over there to protect us, we'll let it go. And then when we're confronted with what that actually means, it's a horrifying thing. So, in general, I've found that it's been very difficult for people to come to the film and to watch it. But once they do watch it, they're gratified, and I think their eyes are opened in some way, because it's a film that looks at this issue from all sorts of points of view, the point of view of the victim, the point of view of the aggressors, and also how it corrupts the very values that we espouse.
Now, well-known film before that was the Enron movie, and that very different in subject matter. It's about Enron, a domestic finance scandal, but in a way they're similar in theme. They're both about the abuse of power. What draws you to that?
Well, I'm interested in the abuse of power, but I'm also interested in corruption, and I think both films in some fundamental way are about corruption. Enron's about economic corruption, and Taxi to the Dark Side is about the corruption of the rule of law, and really the corruption of the human spirit. Mm. And you can see how things that start out innocently enough, being done for the right reasons, because we've been, even Jeff Skilling, said in the film, Jeff Skilling, he being the president of Enron, said, "We're on the side of the angels." He was convinced that what he was doing was right. And likewise, I think a lot of our administration, our civilian administration, were convinced that they were on the right side. So I am interested in the abuse of power, but I'm also interested particularly in how, when people in power feel that what they're doing is right and the end justifies the means, how that leads to a kind of broad corruption throughout society.
The film, it's about individuals down the chain who actually have to enact the policies that are sort of conceived above them, by the people with the real power. And it's a lot like Errol Morris's film Standard Operating Procedure, in that you take a somewhat sympathetic view of these individuals. What's the dynamic between the system and the actors, and where does responsibility lie?
Well, you can't say that the people at the bottom of the chain are not responsible. They are responsible. And after all, there are rules and regulations, and in many cases, they broke them. And also, just in terms of common sense, I mean, this was a poor kid. It was weighted, you know, 130 pounds. There were 220-pounders wailing at this guy. I mean, so much so that we now know, you know, one of the guards kneed him so many times that he had to change legs in order to, you know, because one leg got tired. So I do think that it's not fair to say that these kids are victims or that they should not be held accountable. They should. But what's vicious about what was done to these interrogators and to these military police is that they weren't told, in many cases, specifically what to do. They weren't told, go knee Dilawar in his legs until, you know, he's dead. What they were told was, the gloves are off. And at the same time, they were given tremendous pressure to extract intelligence. So what was worse, in a way, was that they weren't given any guidance, but they were given tremendous pressure, and they were expected to know what that meant. And what that meant in practice was that these guys pushed things further and further and further, and then when they were caught, the people up at the top of the chain of command said, oh, that's not what we meant.
Right.
Even though we know that these their superior officers and sometimes superior civilians were walking in and out of the prison. So it was a very devastating kind of a circumstance where the soldiers were allowed to go way beyond the bounds of any kind of civilized behavior.
And there's plausible denial in part because each of these individuals had to eventually act on his own, I guess.
Right, because there weren't explicit guidelines. I mean, there were kind of de facto guidelines. And what you realized was that, particularly at Bagram, for example, you know, there were sort of policies that normally are not permitted at all, where military intelligence can actually ask a superior officer and military police who are supposed to be in charge of protecting prisoners to actually abuse them in order to soften them up for interrogations. These were things that kind of worked out with a wink and a nod over time. Very few written orders have been demonstrated. But it left these soldiers in a very difficult position at the bottom of the pile because they were supposed to say, yes, sir, we're going to do the mission, sir, and we're going to get that intelligence. And meanwhile, the superior officers are winking and nodding and saying, look, pal, do what you got to do.
Now, Alex, you're on a panel today that marks the launch of the ACLU project called Rights, Camera, Action. And the idea of it is the role of film and arts in the national dialogue of civil liberties. And the movie poster for Taxi to the Dark Side actually ended up ruffling feathers. And if anyone had any doubt about the power of images and arts to affect this conversation, can you go over, tell me what happened with the poster? And
sure. The poster has two soldiers that are accompanying a detainee, you know, marching off into a distant landscape, sort of an Afghan landscape. And we were told on an informal basis by the MPAA that those images were offensive because the detainee was shackled and hooded. And and they said, look, you know, we didn't allow that kind of imagery in Saw. You know, we can't allow it for you. And we said, well, we agree that the images are offensive. But they also happen to be real. And these were taken from actual photographs. And indeed, one of the photographs had already tried to have been banned by the military, and only because it was magically preserved on the hard drive of a camera when the memory stick was erased, did that image manage to survive. So it was, this is the image that would not die. And it was interesting. And over time, I think we won our case with the MPAA, and we got the poster that we wanted. But you can see how the sensitivity towards those images is extreme.
I'd like to bring in for the end of our conversation another voice. We have with us Cal Penn.
How are you?
And the subject I'd like to address is the show 24. Cal, you were on the show this
yes.
past season. And Alex, you have referred to the show as glamorizing torture. What is the problem with that, with doing
What's
that for entertainment?
With glamorizing torture? Oh, nothing, I
Lay
guess,
it out
if
for
you're
me.
Into torture. look, I think the problem is that ultimately, you know, Jack Bauer, look, I know a lot of may their names be, you know, expunged or not mentioned by me, but a lot of, you know, civil rights attorneys who like the show because it's kick-ass and you get your retribution and Jack Bauer takes it out on the bad guys as viciously as possible. But the fact is that, you know, the way he gets that information is based on an utterly false premise. He beats it out of them. He tortures them and he gets good information. What we know about interrogation is that that's absolutely false. And yet these images have incredible power. I know for a fact that Dean Finnegan from West Point actually went out to see the producers of 24 and begged them to stop because his students were so powerfully moved by the images there that that they weren't listening to what, you know, the instructors at West Point were saying about how rapport building actually delivers better actionable intelligence. They were like, oh, no, Pops, that's old school. Jack Bauer does it a different way, and that's the way we're going to do it. So Dean Finnegan went and asked them to stop, and I think that testifies to a number of things, and one of them is the appeal of that hypothetical, this ticking time bomb scenario, and also, you know, how a powerful TV show like that can actually have a pretty profound impact.
And Cal, what was your experience like actually being on? You played a terrorist.
I did, and it's funny because these are exactly the discussions that you sort of have behind the scenes as an actor.
You do. So that,
well, as an actor, it depends. You know, most of these issues are certainly on the writing or producing level, and even sociological level is how certain images affect folks who don't work in the media. From my perspective as an actor, it's a lot different because this was shot, 2 years ago, I think? So you're still kind of at a stage where you want to keep working. I had just done a couple of teen comedies, and so you want to very much do something that shows your range. I'm in real life terrified of guns.
Yeah.
And so I knew in the first meeting we had, I saw that this guy not only was going to hold a gun, but use it and kill somebody with it. So strictly, purely in the vacuum of an acting challenge, that's something that raised a huge positive in my mind. You know, going back to acting class, do things that always scare you. That's the meaning of being an artist.
Were you tortured on the show?
No. So then the other discussion that kind of takes place, and journalists ask me about this sometimes, is the type of role that I played. In my particular plot line, I played a guy who seems to be this American kid who turns out to be part of a sleeper terrorist cell. And what was kind of fascinating is, from an acting perspective, you always ground your character in some sort of reality. And the problem is that, I think this is a nice thing, that we have not had this sort of homegrown terrorism in the United States, with the exception of folks like Timothy McVeigh, to the extent that it's happened in places like the UK, for example. So your job as an actor then becomes to root your character in something real. So what I did with a couple of friends was, you know, did a bunch of research into folks living in the UK and how people were co-opted by the misuse of religion and how poverty and immigration law and the list kind of goes on and on, how that played into what was happening in London at the time, and how to maybe ground that in this fictitious realm in the United States. But because I'm not a producer, it was really just four episodes. The larger discussions about 24 that I've read since then are a lot different than kind of my experience with it. Because for me, from the acting perspective, it was kind of the push your own boundaries and ground it in something. And
it's action. You know,
exactly. But I enjoy very much reading it. There's a great book a couple books that came out on 24 and national security recently, and articles in a couple of journals. And I'm really fascinated by them because it's something that I've started thinking about a lot more now, not just torture and shows that have to do with national security, but, you know, comedies or shows that depict women or people of color in a particular way. It's nice that sort of attention is being paid to particular images. I think it's a debate that's very important.
Well, apparently the ratings for 24 have been going down since the beginning of the Iraq War. There was a recent piece in the Wall Street Journal that talked about how, you know, maybe people don't have the stomach for this kind of thing anymore. Do you think that the national mood has changed since the show has started, Alex?
I think it probably has, because there hasn't been a 9/11 type attack in quite some time. And I do think that the appeal of 24 is, you know, more than indirectly related to that. You know, people want to kick back, and that's the emotional appeal of that. You know, we're going to go get the bad guys and we're going to give them what they gave us.
I think it's an interesting question, because the pilot episode, and I believe part of the first season of 24, was shot in 2000 and the first part of 2001. So the birth of that show was definitely pre-9/11, but but certainly what's been going on in the world with any show on television is taken into account. But then there was recently a writer's strike also, which I know completely shut down that show and a bunch of others. So as far as ratings go, it is a curiosity. I'm on a TV show called House right now, and we've been struggling with the same thing. It's probably the least controversial show on television right now. We kill patients, but that's about it.
Right.
So, but that's, you know, that's kind of the nature of television in this world where there are, what, four or five major media conglomerates left, and how that all ties together. I am curious to see if there's a bounce back with that show and a bunch of others after everything recoups itself.
Yeah, I heard actually they're gonna address the whole reaction to Jack Bauer this season.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, that's what I heard.
That's
that
cool.
He was gonna go before a Senate subcommittee and have to defend his actions.
I was intrigued in all these discussions that even some of the, you know, the terrorist operatives and covert maneuvers were going on in that show in the White House itself, that there were presidents and vice presidents, and it just that's I'm sorry, I'm going off on a tangent, but that's actually fascinating to me. I wish I was in this coming up season.
I think this goes beyond 24 though too. I mean, I think it's natural. It's a natural human instinct, and movies capitalize on that. I mean, look back at Dirty Harry. Dirty Harry was not the classic habeas corpus Miranda rights reading character. You know?
It's about vigilante justice.
Yeah. It's like, okay, all this, you know, stuff has gotten too complicated. You know, read them their rights. Forget it. They're just going to get out of jail and they're going to stick it to us again. We need a guy like Dirty Harry who's going to take, you know, the law into his own hands. And it's emotionally appealing. But writ large, it's a serious problem.
I think it's great that these conversations, like I said, are being had. It's something that historically you've seen that trend with Japanese Americans in the 40s and particular types of images in comic books. You know, and these are comic books that mostly kids were watching. There's a really famous cover of Superman comics that says Superman says slap a Jap. And that was wildly popular at that time. You know, the Cold War was a little bit different, but there are still images. Look at Rocky, you know, or look at Rambo. Maybe it was because I was a kid, but I don't remember those conversations being as mainstream and as widespread as they are now. And I think that's a great thing, because ultimately, whether we enjoy shows like 24 or not, to have those conversations and understand that there is a reality of torture that's going on right now that needs to be addressed in a very serious fashion is a positive thing.
Do we have just another second?
Because yeah, of course.
There's something that you raised that I made me think of something else, which is, one of the interesting things about torture and the rules against it that the military has, those rules actually are premised on a pretty progressive idea, which is, look, as a soldier, your job is to kill the enemy. That's your job, okay? But when you get a prisoner who's before you, helpless, and you have that prisoner in your control, you're supposed to imagine that that prisoner is you. And that could be you, and therefore you're supposed to treat that prisoner as you would want to be treated. That's the essence of that's part of the essence of the whole Geneva Conventions and everything else. Okay, but then the essence of a lot of the imagery that took place in World War II, particularly with the Japanese, and also the imagery, post 9/11, the essence of the argument for torture is that these people are not like us. They don't respond in the same way as other human beings. Their DNA is different. Therefore, the normal techniques don't work. So we have to have Jack Bauer out there because he's the only guy that can get it out of them. And that's really interesting. But I think we're a little bit more sensitive, I hope, to that appeal now.
And it should be said that the ACLU is one of the few organizations speaking out against Japanese internment during World War II. And so this organization's had a place in these conversations for a long time. Cal Penn, Alex Gibney, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
You can hear a separate interview with Cal Penn, where he talks about his political aspirations and his work in the movie Harold and Kumar: Escape from Guantanamo. That's available on the website, aclu.org. You can also hear more of these conversations from the 2008 membership conference by going to the iTunes Music Store and searching for ACLU. This is Matt Dellinger.